You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
Hello, I'm Christy Niebel, currently filling in for David Gilmore to host Sound Poetry today with Pamela Hobart Carter from Seattle. Her writing credentials are extensive and varied. Her recently published book of poetry, Hiking Red Pass, was nominated for the Pushcart Prize. She's written short stories, flash fiction, and a young adult novel, nonfiction, which runs the gamut of topics from science to poetry in publications for teachers, to numerous articles for the Seattle Star. She quit teaching full-time 7.5 years ago to be a full-time writer. She's had two recently published poetry chapbooks in the last 2 years, and she's also a playwright with quite a number of plays which have been both produced and read locally and in Montreal. She has her MS in geology from Indiana University, and she has taught pre-K and poetry in Seattle, and she's been a visiting poetry teacher from 2014 to the present. She's been in the Playground Poetry Program, a visiting poet in Seattle Public Schools. Your publications, if you like. The most recent ones were her Imaginary Museum, Kelsey Books 2020, and Held Together with Tape and Glue. Those are two poetry chapbooks from the last 2 years. Now, would you like to kick it off by correcting anything I've said, or by please read a poem?
Well, thanks, Christy. The Hiking to Red Pass, the poem that was nominated, it's a poem. And it was at Points and Parks and Poems. And the Playground Poetry that you mentioned, that was a summer program that I taught in Seattle Public Schools a few years back. Solstice Crow. This poem is for my friend Paul Mullen, for whom the solstice is always very significant. Solstice Crow. On our downward voyage through ebony hours, you love to count seconds crossed off solar smolder, a door shouting before stroke of solstice. Hope crowds join you to note momentousness of orbital motifs. Longest or shortest, most. Fathoming only cold gloom or profound loss, forgetful of coming solid luminosity, months of protracted yellow, forgetful of our rotational rondo, or seasonally disordered, others drown below low color atmospheres. Eons ago, you vowed to horn blow upon those moments of shortest solar showing. Now your song jogs lost memory of cosmic knowledge. On solstice, obscurity comes to ground. Journeys aloft closely follow journeys down into shadowy coal. Solar glow grows post-solstice. Orbs bounce. Old souls drop into tombs, carom out, reborn. Solstice Crow, you forge reason to rejoice.
I love this poem for a lot of different reasons. One reason is that you celebrate the crow and the sense of its relationship to the seasonal changes and its flight. And there's a lot of wordplay in here that's fun as well as being pretty profound. The one that I think I would trip on if I were trying to recite this, I think I would probably have a really hard time. I'm going to do it really slowly. Solar glow grows pulse post. See, I didn't do it post solstice. Say that 5 times really fast.
I don't know if I can. But you get one of the things that I enjoyed about making this one was that I challenged myself to have an O in every word. So the diction was slowly accrued for me in building this poem, and to try and get the meaning that I wanted to come through, even while adhering to this little rule that I made for myself. I liked what it did sonically.
A lot, yeah. Rotational rondo, and then I love this, seasonally disordered. That's me, I'm getting seasonally disordered.
Well, I do know some people who unfortunately suffer from that seasonal disorder of the with the lack of light, especially in our gray Northwest. I know that they need some big doses of light.
We're ready to karum out reborn. A little time to wait here for that.
But just a little longer.
What the listener can't see is this is kind of a visually interesting piece of poetry architecture. And I don't know how you managed to do it, but it makes an arc on the page.
I wanted the lines to look like they were dropping down and then coming big
back
again.
Love that. Yeah, cool. Well, I thought that your poems seem to be, in some cases, inspired by visual art. I noticed this guy, Robert Raynard, mentioned in your poetry. You want to tell us a little bit about him?
Robert Raynard is a Londoner currently. He used to work at the Tate Museum, and I met entirely through social media. My cousin was on an art history site that he was also on, and she connected me to him because the three of us had this mutual interest in looking at visual art. And Robert very commonly posted photographs of artwork from the Tate. And I loved seeing these. And then COVID came along and Robert was no longer daily in the Tate and posting these photographs. And instead he switched to posting his own photography that was taken very commonly during the brief periods that were encouraged to be outdoors and exercise and so on. So he's often on his bike and would take these, I think, fabulous pictures of London and life in these last couple of years. And one of them just hit me particularly hard one day looking at it, and I was thinking, this is this poem. And so I wrote the first poem and I shared it with him. And he was, I think, quite pleased that that had happened, that kind of connection. And then I realized that there was another that I wanted to write about, and it has become a thing. I've now written, I think, a dozen poems based on his photography. And I hope one day that we can get the collection of poems and his photographs published in a little book together. That would be a terrific thing to me. But it's a relationship that's grown just through this communication, this intercontinental thing. I think we're both enjoying it a lot.
Yeah, that was serendipity. It doesn't always work out to be a marriage of hearts when two people in two different media try to get together and create something as a joint project. You guys just magically somehow melded.
It's just happened. And I do find he has a very particular perception. I think he's very good at locating beauty. I think he's also quite amazingly skilled at capturing a mood that is transient, or even a whole, the whole gestalt of of lockdown in London, this, you know, a bare street with someone else on a bicycle, not very many vehicles, of course. And there's a feeling of this is what things are like right now that often comes through in, for me, in his lovely work.
Is his work accessible publicly?
I don't think so. I think you have to be friends with him on one of these social media places. But I might encourage him that way. I know he's an Instagrammer and he's a Facebooker. And I admit to being on these things to see his work and others too. It's actually one of the things that I think is quite wonderful, that we can have these sorts of relationships that are by virtue of these electronic signals.
Digital technology. Is there one of the poems that you've written about his photography that you might like to read?
Flight Over a Quiet Square was the first, and I will read that. And this is in my chapbook held together with tape and glue. Flight Over a Quiet Square. When a bird flies toward you and you raise your lens, you can't be sure the solar angle or the contrast between its white plumage and the shaded verticals of formal colonnades and fancy fenestration behind it will show to the advantage you imagine. You frame strong sun painting feathers bright through the gull's fanned tail and wing edge and flying form at an active banking angle, about to alight on pale gray pavers, discreetly delineated foreground. We dream of flight, of riding sky, of letting a wind hold us aloft, landing as easily here as on a rooftop.
That's interesting to me in that a person who takes photography seriously begins to see everything differently. And it, to me, it provides an artistic view of the world. And that's in that poem, I think.
Thank you. I think the eye is mistaken for being like a camera and the camera like an eye often. And what we choose to frame can be so different from what is before us. Yeah, a lot about choice of what to present, what to think about, where to be. All of it can come through in a photograph.
Photography is such a craze now, but I don't think much of it probably is very artistic. You got your degree in geology, and you've made such a transition in your direction in life to poetry and writing in general. How did that happen?
Both slowly and a little bit by chance. And there was some forgetting involved. When I was in high school, I, with some classmates, did some adaptations, and we just felt fairly invincible, as teenagers often do, and so, oh yeah, we can write plays, and took on some script writing for ourselves, and I did a couple of very short scripts by myself, and I totally forgot that I'd done them for years and years and years. And from geology grad school, I became a science teacher, and that involved teaching more generally and teaching different ages. And one day, an idea for a poem arrived, and I worked on it for a really long time. It amazed me by getting published, and it was a bit of a setup because I thought, oh, this is what it's going to be like. I'll write these and they'll, you know, I'll submit them and there they'll be in print. And nothing happened afterwards for quite a while longer in the poetry area. but I have submitted a lot. And in terms of the playwriting, I went to a festival of short plays at the University of Washington, and I loved them. They were 10-minute plays, and I came away thinking, I want to write this script, I want to write that script, and got back into playwriting, and then was kind of remembering, it's like, oh yeah, I have done some of this before. And when I was a teenager, I loved reading plays, which a lot of playwrights even think is weird. Most folks don't really enjoy reading scripts, but I loved reading scripts. And my parents had a lot of good collections of various playwrights, and I'd just plow through a playwright at a time. And I felt like I guess, in retrospect, had the form in my head that way. And the poetry, I had various forms and familiarity with too, sort of lurking, I think, from childhood as well. We had at our school in Montreal, from fourth grade through 11th grade, a school-wide poetry reciting contest annually. And it meant that every year, all of us were spending this time by ourselves hunting through poetry books to choose the poem that we were going to recite, because everybody recited one in their class. And I think there were a couple of us chosen from each class to recite in front of the school. And then, you know, there would be a winner of this recital. I equated myself with a lot of poetry that way. And return to a number of those books when it wasn't time to be competing at school.
This is a poetry show. No, we've got to hear more of your poetry. So would you like to pick another poem to read, please?
Yes, I'll read We Dream of the Dead and They Are Not Dead. This is from her imaginary museum.
I like that one.
We dream of the dead and they are not dead. You emailed about your dream. The old boyfriend appears for casual conversation at the rural home of our grandparents. But he is dead. Killed himself some years ago. Dream minds don't care about death. We can talk to anyone when we dream, and they are not dirt covered or ghostly or the least bit decayed. They wear khakis and button downs and sandals because they are in the countryside. Their skin looks like our own browns and pinks, and they tell us no special secrets about what lies beyond. Then his head vaporizes. Dead and headless old boyfriends sit like regular folk in rattan chairs in our dreams. Their heads reappear if we keep talking, and may look more insecty, big blinkless eyes on stalks, perhaps no mouth. Through his metamorphoses, though, he remains himself. In my own dreams, I've heard my mother-in-law's voice, absent from waking life more than a decade. And the other night, hugged our grandfather, who died when I was in grad school. Oh, sister, our dreams can be so good to us, even if a little Dali-esque. They say, see, he is living still. See, he is forever in your cells. Find him there whenever you sleep.
That one particularly moved me, I guess, because I've long felt that people who are not in the room with me are very much a part of me. And that includes people who are still alive.
Likewise. And it was for me a big revelation had actually happened for me when I was meditating one time, that I had an encounter with my grandfather and realized he is always with me. And it was overwhelming in every regard. And I love the idea and have held it really close since then, that these people we love, we carry in us, and they are part of us physically and mentally, all of it.
The more time we spend with a person, the more that person has the opportunity to dig into our souls and stay forever.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a lovely poem. It's a poem of grief, and yet it's a poem of joy. You have another one you'd like to read?
Sure. What about Commonplace Epiphanies?
Sounds good.
Okay, this is from Held Together with Tape and Glue. Commonplace Epiphanies. While you nap, the world as you know it pulses, not as a heart, but in the way of celestial bodies, jingling according to private sheet music. It seems when you wake, a whole new sphere chimes around you. You recognize this home. It isn't a mirage or a prior century. No minstrel sings below your castle wall. You consider that the changes may be your own, something interior and of nearly invisible dimension, or perhaps you and the earth mutated synchronously. None of your friends notice how altered you are since last reckoning. While sleeping, you lived in a forlorn kingdom of velvet and silver and lost jewels. A troubadour did serenade you, or was an owl asking if it were alone. Most of us doubt the individual's power to metamorphose, and yet this globe and you and I have been at least seven mortals apiece since Monday noon.
That poem, to me, seemed to be just called to the inner world of possibilities.
It's always a surprise to me how, and this may seem like a non sequitur, but it really does connect for me, how if I set a crossword puzzle aside and come back to it at a later time, a clue that I had no idea how to solve will just be there. And I feel as if each time I approach it, I am, in fact, a different person. And I know it doesn't necessarily have to involve sleep, but I do feel as if sleep is in there. And I was thinking to follow this one with the prior poem because of the sleep connection and the metamorphoses that I think are possible for us. And this poem I wrote, I wrote kind of as a retort to a friend who was arguing that we don't have much capacity for change. And I feel as if we do. And so that was the instigation for this one for me, was that, yeah, this happens, I think, in a pretty steady way throughout our lives, that we are making ourselves over in different ways.
So On the Word, is that the one you were thinking of reading?
On the Word. Here we are, on the page, on the word, on the dot, or the hook, or the serif. Here we are, in the big city, in this house, in this room, or the kitchen. Here lies truth. Truth lies here on the sofa with us, where our feet are up, stocking footed, shoes tidily stowed in the closet when we came in from clearing dead leaves from the hollyhocks this morning, as yesterday, and hundreds of days before. We made our beds, raised our blinds, breakfasted, despite the churn in our guts forecasting world's end. That day has not come. We lied in saying here we are. We are at a distance. We must shout and tell aloud to arrive, or led to the small room where we die. In the days to come, we will tend our gardens, some of which are tiny pots on a windowsill, like old-fashioned desk blotters, turning ink drops into soft-edged discs. We'll drink in sunshine. Soon, darkness will enshroud us. We are throughout, so typically ourselves, frantic about tumbling through rabbit holes, though we'd love to land in a magic place. gleeful at the tree turning pink, the sky going blue, thrilled by a phrase in a book. We even jot it down to remember. The scaffold always rattles, every tower crumbles, we cry and laugh about details, generalities. How did we get so good at calendars and clocks, still ignorant of true passage?
I love this poem at a number of levels. It gives a more detailed look at the value of the intricate moments that pass by in our daily lives, because with COVID all around us, we still have to do these things just to glue ourselves together, and everything really does matter. It's at the end that I feel COVID moves into this, at least for me personally. How did we get so good at calendars and clocks, still ignorant of true passage? Because true passage seems to be changing with COVID for me anyway.
I find time very confusing during COVID, and I probably have always wondered about time. For geology, it's a foundational aspect to consider long, long time. And I think that appealed greatly to me when I was studying it, just thinking about the age of the rocks that I was studying, the length of time that this planet existed without life, the length of time it has taken before humans appeared on this planet's surface, and how little that may feel as if it has any bearing on us with our daily lives, and that especially during COVID, it could be hard to know where 1 month or year or day or hour begins or ends. I keep hearing people talking about, oh, a year of this. It's almost 2 years here, and it's a startlingly long time to have been plunged into this very different way of being. And all of us at once, just a really transformative event.
You have some lines that seem to give meaning to it all. We must shout until we arrive, until allowed to arrive. In days to come, we will tend our gardens, some of which are tiny pots on a windowsill. You know, if we don't do these things, just... it's all a part of something that has to be done. All of these little minutia is glued together. It's inextricable and it's all necessary. At least that's what I'm seeing in your poem.
I do feel that way. And it does keep me glued together. I have a poem about making the bed that it is really important to me.
Me
and
too.
It does help me launch the day and feel that I've had that marker.
I share that with you.
It's also something that's talking, you know, returning to the visual things. It's creating a transformation that one can see that shows that a certain period is over. That period of being stretched out between the sheets and now, you know, it's time to be vertical and moving about.
I think there's beauty in a bed that's made well.
Agreed. It's also a family connection in there for me, which maybe sounds strange to feel sentimental about bed making, but my sister and I went about the whole house when we spent a summer month every summer during our childhood with our grandparents. And so there were a lot of people in the house, and we made everybody's beds for them after breakfast. That was just what we did. We went from room to room and we made beds. And so it was time with my sister, but it was also something we felt like we were, I think, able to contribute as small people in the house, that that we were creating some of the structure of things?
You definitely were. Well, I have a bunch of questions here that I have not yet asked you, which seems so important to me, but we have killed 30 minutes here, so maybe we could do this again sometime.
That would be lovely. I've enjoyed myself thoroughly.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. And so I'm going to conclude this. Thank you very much, Pamela Hobart Carter, Pam. And this concludes Sound Poetry. I'm Christy Niebel, filling in for David Gilmore.